We are currently working our way through some of the transition material between the Old and the New Testaments and looking at key events that will help us understand the New Testament better. If you are interested in following in your own copy of this, all you have to do is find Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. We're looking at book number 11, and we're in chapter number 8 of book number 11 today. We're dealing with the coming of Alexander the Great to the Middle East, and how in 332 BC, he arrived at Jerusalem. Now, he was coming there, he thought, to punish the high priest and the Jewish people for not immediately supporting him in his fight against Darius, the final king of the Persian Empire. They didn't feel they could do that because they'd made an oath in the name of God to Darius not to lend support to anyone fighting against him. Well, when Alexander arrived, he saw the high priest in his full uniform with the plate, the golden plate on his forehead with the name of God, and this peaceful entourage, exactly as he'd seen in a dream when he was still in Macedonia, and that the God represented by this high priest had told him to take over the empire. And so instead of annihilating the high priest and the Jewish people and the Jewish faith, Alexander the Great turns around and honors them all. And that is quite shocking to the people that were supporting him at the time, but it shouldn't be all that surprising to those of us who understand. The book of Daniel had already predicted this transfer of power from the Persians to the Greeks. And so this is fulfillment of prophecy. Now, on his visit to Jerusalem in 332, something else happens that ties into that part of our story. And this is from subparagraph 5 of chapter 8 in Antiquities, book 11. It says, when the book of Daniel was showed him, so the Jewish people got out their sacred writings, including the book of Daniel, in their language. They showed him wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians. And he supposed that himself was the person intended. And as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. So they actually show him prophetic passages. We're talking about Daniel chapter 8 being one of those. The Persians would be done in by the coming Greeks. He believed that he was fulfilling that prophecy at that point. And so he feels really connected to the Jewish people. So the next day, it tells us, he called them to himself and he bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they should enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh years. So they request that they be allowed, as had happened underneath the Persians, to keep their Jewish laws, the laws of Moses. And that included the seventh year rest. So they would pay their taxes in the years that they worked, years 1 through 6 of the cycle. But every seventh year, because they did not work in that year, the Greeks from Alexander onward would not require them to pay taxes. Continues, it says, he granted all that they desired, and when they entreated that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired. So they were not asking just for themselves here in Jerusalem and Judea. They were saying, could you allow, could you protect the religious observances of Jews all over your empire? And he said, yes, I'll do that. Now, one other thing of interest to us is this. When he said to the multitude that if any of them would enlist themselves in his army on this condition, that they should continue under the law of their forefathers and live according to them, he was willing to take them with him. Many were ready to accompany him in his wars. Now, one of the things that we see Alexander the Great do is that as he moves forward in his blitzkrieg of a war, he takes many of the ethnic groups that he's just conquered and adds them into his army. He basically makes them into his new allies. And so that's what he does with the Jewish people. But he has to make special concessions to them. Because remember, they have very specific dietary laws that they have to follow and ceremonial cleansing that they have to follow. They also do not work on the Sabbath day or in Sabbath years. So we know that Alexander the Great had Jewish military units, which were completely Jewish, had Jewish commanders. They had Jewish food provided for them, and they did not fight on the Sabbath day, and they would not have been required to fight in sabbatical years. But there were Jewish military units in the Greek army, and that will happen for years hereafter, many years after Alexander passes from the scene. Well, let's go ahead and talk about how Alexander does pass from the scene. We know that he went down and conquered Egypt and Babylonia in 331. In 330, he ends up taking over the rest of the Persian Empire because Darius III is assassinated by his own men. 324 B.C., Alexander had pushed his Greek empire clear out into northwest modern India, and then he returned back to Mesopotamia. And then in 323, he dies. We don't know exactly why he dies. He catches something, some disease, some illness. He dies at age 32 in Mesopotamia. He did not have a legitimate adult heir when he died. Therefore, his empire was immediately divided up among his generals. Eventually, it settles down to about four of these guys getting four chunks of his kingdom. Now, we, in our studies, are only interested in two of those four. Now, we're kind of interested in the four because that's what the book of Daniel predicts. Remember, the unigoat represented Alexander. And then when his horn is broken off, that means the death of Alexander. There's four horns that come up in place. So we do have that connection to the four Greek empires that follow Alexander's death, but we're more interested in the two Greek empires that bracket the Promised Land. And that would be the kingdom to the south, centered out of Egypt, out of the city of Alexandria, and the kingdom to the north in Syria that was headquartered out of Antioch, Syria. And that would be called the Seleucid Kingdom after the first king on that. So down in Egypt, the successor of Alexander was Ptolemy. We call him Ptolemy I in 323 BC. It's interesting. He seems to have kidnapped the body of Alexander, which was preserved in honey, and buries it in a tomb in Alexandria. And that's funny because that was one of the ways of asserting your right to the throne, is that you're the one that got to entomb the previous king and had control of his tomb. So that's when the Ptolemaic kingdom starts, in 323 BC. Now, Josephus lets us know that there's a lot of back and forth fighting between all these different fragments of Alexander's kingdom. And that includes some fighting back and forth between the people in control in Mesopotamia and Ptolemy down in Egypt. And in the midst of all that fighting, there were some Jewish people that ended up being caught as prisoners of war and taken to Egypt by Ptolemy. And then they were made into slaves. I mention that because that will be important in a story that's coming up. So that all happened in the three teens of, we're talking about the 4th century BC. Eventually, though, one of Ptolemy's supported people takes power in Mesopotamia and in Syria. This guy is known to us now as Seleucus I, and he becomes the king of Syria in 312 BC. And so things are dated from his accession, and that's important to us in our chronology work. And so the next thing that happens is that in 280 BC, the king of Macedonian Egypt, Ptolemy I, dies. And his son, Ptolemy II, comes to power. And Ptolemy II has an interest in writing, in books, that is, scrolls that have been written down in the past. And there is a man working for him that has suggested a project to Ptolemy II, something that he's already been working with Ptolemy I. And that is, let's collect all the writings of the world into one location. And so this is the beginning of what we know today as the Library of Alexandria. And when Ptolemy II checks in with his librarian, he finds out that right around 280 BC, he's already collected 200,000 individual scrolls into this library. And he believes that he can stay on track to collect as many as 500,000 within just a matter of years. And so it becomes the goal of the Library of Alexandria to copy into the Greek language specifically every bit of writing in the known world. The librarian is aware that the Jewish people have some really significant religious writings that they hold in high esteem. But those writings are in Hebraic characters. These Hebrew characters are similar to the writings of other Mesopotamian peoples, but they are unique to their own language in their pronunciation, their syntax, their grammar. And so the librarian recommends to him, we need to pursue getting these Jewish holy books translated into Greek and put into the library. But we need to convince the Jewish people to let that happen, because these are, after all, their holy books. And so the way you can do it, King, is you've got 100,000 plus Jewish slaves here in Egypt. If you were to declare them free and then ask the Jewish high priest to let us copy, translate and copy their sacred writings, they would be much more prone to doing exactly that. And so that's what King Ptolemy II did. He paid, I think it was like 120 silver coins for each Jewish slave that was in his kingdom. That's basically, you know, 120 days' wages. So many tens of thousands of dollars of value. And all those people went back to the Promised Land area, back to Judea. Well, not all of them. Some of them actually decided to join Ptolemy II's Greek armies. The king sent out his request, his official request, to the high priest through the librarian to collect the sacred writings. And I'm going to read to you a little bit from chapter 2 of Antiquities, book number 12 at this point. And it says, when once Ptolemy asked him how many tens of thousands of books he'd collected, he replied he already had 20 times 10,000, and that in a little time he should have 50 times 10,000. But he said he had been informed that there were many books of laws among the Jews worthy of inquiring after and worthy of the king's library, but which, being written in characters and in dialect of their own, will cause no small pains in getting them translated into the Greek tongue, that the character in which they were written seems to be like that which is the proper character of the Syrians, and that its sound when pronounced is like theirs also, and that this sound appears to be peculiar to themselves. Wherefore he said that nothing hindered why he might not get those books to be translated also. And so that's what I was just summarizing a little while ago, the background for why they wanted to translate these books. Now, the guy who is working all of this, he has the approach that we need to get these holy books into our Greek language, because after all, there's really only one God out there. They have a name for him, but we call him Zeus. It's all about the life giver. And so there's really some overlap between our Greek faith and the Jewish faith. Now, that's not accurate. That's not true. Zeus and he who is are not one in the same. Zeus is, at best, a twisted representation of the true and living God. But you can appreciate and understand why this guy would kind of present it that way in trying to convince the king of the importance of getting these things written. And so, long story short, he makes the request that six scholars in the written word of God in Hebrew from each of the 12 tribes, because clearly the guy that's working all this out knows Jewishness pretty well. He decides there needs to be six people from each of the 12 tribes, so a total of 72. 72 elders need to be invited to come to Egypt with their holy books and translate them here. Now, they send not just the slaves back, but they also send all sorts of gold and silver items to convince the Jewish people to go along with this. And they do. Until finally, they arrive and they meet with the king. And then they are given a special private place in Alexandria to do their translation work. I want to read to you from when these translators, these 72 translators, arrive in Alexandria. And this is what it says. I'm reading now from Antiquities 12, chapter 2, subsection 11. It says, when they'd come to Alexandria, and Ptolemy heard that they'd come, that the 70 elders, it's 72, had come also, he presently sent for Andreas and Aristus, his ambassadors who came to him, and he delivered them the epistle, the letter, which they brought him from the high priest, and made answer to all the questions he put to them by word of mouth. He then made haste to meet the elders that came from Jerusalem for the interpretation of the laws, and he gave command that everybody who came on other occasions should be sent away. So basically he says, no more appointments. I am totally focused on these guys that are arriving from Judea. Which was a thing surprising, and what he did not used to do. For those that were drawn thither upon such occasions used to come to him on the fifth day, but ambassadors at the month's end. But when he had sent them away, he waited for these that had been sent by Eleazar the priest. But as the old men came in with presents, which the high priest had given them to bring to the king, and with the membranes upon which they had their laws written in golden letters. Now, this is where we now have an actual historical description of the holy books, the holy scrolls, in the 3rd century BC, right around 280 BC. They are very thin leather scrolls. And the ink that's been used on them has been tinted gold. So these are special edition scrolls. Now that is quite shocking to the later Jewish scholars, because the Talmud, which is traditional Jewish teaching from the time after the Second Temple was destroyed, we're talking about during the Christian era, during the Middle Ages and things, they said it is illegal to write on the scrolls in gold lettering. But apparently at one time, it was done that way. So he sees these membranes upon which they had their laws written in golden letters. He put questions to them concerning these books. And when they'd taken off the covers whereon they were wrapped up, and that's very Jewish tradition. Even modern-day Jews, when they bring out their scrolls, they have to take a covering off of them in order to unroll them. So that's kind of the picture we have here. They showed him the membranes. So he's not touching them, but he's looking at them very closely. So the king stood admiring the thinness of those membranes. So this leather is so thin, it's shocking to him. It's not like other scrolls that he's seen. And then the exactness of the junctures, which could not be perceived. So exact were they connected one with another. What they're talking about here is the leather that they use is only so long. But the scrolls need a whole bunch of these leathers connected to one another in order to make the full scroll. So they had a way that they would connect these separate pieces of leather together. But these have been done so well that the king can't hardly see the seam. He has to really get up close and be shown exactly where it's at before he can perceive it. So that's pretty amazing. And this he did for a considerable time. And then he said that he returned them thanks for coming to him, and still greater thanks to to him that sent them. That'd be the high priest. Above all, to that God whose laws they appeared to be. Then did the elders and those that were present with him cry out with one voice, wished all happiness to the king, upon which he fell into tears by the violence of the pleasure he had, it being natural to men to afford the same indications in great joy that they do under sorrow. He then turns the books back over to them and tells them to get busy with their translation work. So what we see here is the beginning of what we know today as the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the first Greek translation made from the original Hebrew scripture of old. So the books of Moses, all the books of the prophets, it'd be 22 books altogether by Jewish count. It's still the exact same things we know today as the 39 books of the Old Testament. They just count them differently than we do. So those 22 scrolls brought from Jerusalem, beautiful in their working with the golden lettering, these guys, these 72 guys, are going to translate from Hebrew into Greek. So they are well-versed in both languages. These are scholars. And according to the tradition that we will kick off tomorrow's session with, it took them 72 days to do it. So 72 guys working for 72 days to make the Septuagint, which is why the common abbreviation for the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, is LXX, which is the Latin number 72. So come back tomorrow, and we will continue with our transition study between the Old Testament and the New Testament to know God is at work in history.